based on that, does one need a solid background in Judaism to read or really truly appreciate Agnon?
Well, those are two different questions. To read Agnon, one does not need a solid grounding in Judaism. One need not have read all of these books behind me. You don't need to be a learned rabbi. As a matter of fact, you don't even need to do it in Hebrew. There's some very, very fine translations to English and to all other languages. Some of them edited by myself. Some of them even translated by myself, if I can toot my own translator's pen. As a matter of fact, those judges in Stockholm that gave him the Nobel Prize, the only time Hebrew literature was so honored, they all read him in translation. It's a very typically chauvinistic Israeli question, which is posed to me all the time. How could you possibly read Agnon in translation? How could you translate Agnon, right? Which is the same question you could get in the streets of Moscow about Tolstoy or Dostoevsky. It's the same question you could get in Madrid about Cervantes. It's the same question you can get in London about Shakespeare. Right, every nation, every culture has its own, you know, great literary hero, which you can't imagine, you know, can't imagine reading him in any foreign language. Only the Yiddish translation of Shakespeare was famously advertised as being verteicht und verbessert, translated and improved in the Yiddish. Only once you've read it, and only once you've read Lear in the original Yiddish, do you truly appreciate it. But that was just a kind of Yiddish man's arrogance. But obviously, we read in translation all the time, right? And even when we don't read in translation, when we're reading the classics, so much is lost. Do we really appreciate every reference and cultural hint between the lines of Shakespeare today, even though we are readers of English? No, we certainly don't. And of course, there are very many, you know, scholarly reference works that will help fill in those blanks, but you don't need that. You don't need that to understand the meaning of Hamlet or King Lear or Macbeth, right? The meaning is plain. And it's a mistake to think that, oh, well, we can't. I remember when I was in high school, when ninth grade, they started teaching us Shakespeare. And I remember there was just this sense that, oh, Shakespeare's really hard. I mean, I think the teachers did us a disservice by creating this kind of idea. It's actually in other contexts in my work in education, I've compared it to sometimes what happens when students begin learning Gemara here in Israeli schools, when students begin learning Gemara towards the end of elementary school. You know, they're told Gemara is very serious. We were told Shakespeare is very serious. It takes a lot of effort. It takes a lot of work. It scares everybody off even before they open the book, right? They become convinced that they can't do it. They become convinced that this is too hard for them. There is no, you know, we have here in Jerusalem is a wonderful amateur Shakespeare company they do Shakespeare in the Park every summer in Jerusalem. And we take our kids, you know, we have younger children and, you know, we've been doing it for years from the time they were very young. It's amazing. They're able to follow certainly the outlines of the plot, you know, besides the fact that, you know, Shakespeare was written to be consumed by the masses. It wasn't some kind of highfalutin thing that only the intelligentsia would understand. Right? Even school children are able to understand Shakespeare and certainly able to understand Agnon. Now, that doesn't mean they're going to catch every reference to Chazal or, by the way, to very many, you know, historical references that were contemporary to Agnon's time, you know, earlier in the 20th century. Historical figures, historical events, both in Europe and Germany and in the land of Israel. That's why we have scholarship. That's why we have reference works. And, you know, after all, we do all carry around the, you know, the collected wisdom of civilization in our pockets. If one need to, we can, you know, look things up. But the stories themselves are eminently understandable. And that's why they have such universal universal appeal. Some stories are a little easier to swallow. Others require a little more heavy lifting in terms of, you know, understanding certain concepts and whatnot. But I think that that's the answer to the question. Now, that being said, there is no doubt that those of us that are familiar with the rabbinic canon and the rabbinical texts, even, you know, very many Americans who are fluent in rabbinic sources, but for whatever reason won't or can't read modern Hebrew literature in the original and will read it in translation. Even in translation, in a good translation, those readers will or should catch a lot of the references, even in translation, to classical sources, the classical mikorot, to verses in the Bible or passages in the rabbinic writings, and we'll be able to consider, oh, what is he doing by drawing our attention to that particular Gemara? And when he does that, you know, what is he doing? Sometimes Agnon made a reference to some classical source, you know, just because that was the kind of, he wanted to pepper his prose with those kinds of turns of phrase. It's just simply a linguistic turn. Other times he's trying to create an intertextual bridge, where he's trying to get us to consider, oh, well, how does this modern story, how is it built on the template of an Agadah? Right? How is this modern story somehow in dialogue with that classical text? And then sometimes he's doing it ironically. He's taking the source out of context. He's flipping it on its head in order to draw our attention to exactly how deviant the plot here is from the classic template. And of course, you know, people, interpreters of with integrity can debate, you know, which kind of source is it? Is it this or is it that or is it the other thing? And that's part of the work of interpretation of the text. But first, those sources have to be identified. But even if you don't identify them, like I presume those judges in Stockholm, you understand this is world-class literature. It works on the level of the surface reading without having to go, you know, underneath in order to tease out all of those references.
You've written about the relationship between Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook and what was that relationship, and how did Rabbi Cook view Agnon in terms of his possible place in Jewish literature and history?
Oh, thank you for referencing that article I had written a number of years ago. It was published. You mentioned that I'm the editor of the journal Tradition, so our listeners can visit traditiononline.org. And in the archives, you can find that article discussing the relationship between Agnon and Rav Kook. Rav Kook, you know, who I'm sure our listeners know, was this colossally important 20th century rabbinic figure. He becomes the first Ashkenazic chief rabbi of the land of Israel before the establishment of the state. But at the time that Agnon arrives in Yafo in 1908, Rav Kook was the rabbi of the town. He had arrived a number of years prior, and he was the rabbi of Yafo, of Jaffa. Agnon was, you know, almost a full generation younger than Rav Kook. But Rav Kook, as part of his Zionist ethos, understood that Zionism couldn't just be about bringing Jews to the land of Israel or back to the land of Israel. It wasn't just about building up the infrastructure of society here between these borders. And it wasn't even just about creating the physical facts on the ground that could one day lead to an autonomous Jewish state. It had to be part of a larger spiritual and cultural revival. That part of being a nation means, yes, you have a state, and yes, you have control over your own affairs, but you also have your expansive culture. And through all the years of the diaspora, we didn't have that. We were culturally handicapped. our cultural efforts, of course, were always maintained in that portable homeland in the text, in our books, in our Bate Midrash. And we poured a lot of our intellectual and spiritual creativity into developing a Torah literature. But a healthy nation has its own language, and a healthy nation is able to conduct its affairs in that language. And a healthy nation is able to be culturally creative in that language. And while, of course, Rav Kook thought our first commitments were to Torah, Chayenu V'yorech Yameinu, he thought that part of the return was going to be this revival. And that's why, as opposed to kind of like the old guard that saw the modernization or the revival of Hebrew as a modern language as a kind of sacrilege, because you're taking the holy tongue and using it for the car mechanic and the pharmacy. That's what Yiddish is for. Yiddish is the language of everyday life. Modern Zionism and modern religious Zionism saw the return to Hebrew as a great spiritual and cultural achievement. And Rav Kook says, we need to have our own modern Hebrew, modern Jewish literature. Because if we revive Hebrew in a way that we can translate Dostoevsky and Cervantes into Hebrew, which was done, that doesn't ipso facto make it Hebrew and certainly not Jewish literature. It's Russian or Spanish literature in translation. And translation is wonderful. As I mentioned earlier, we all consume culture in translation. But translation allows you to be a tourist. Translation opens doors to other worlds and other cultures that you would not have access to without it. And like a tourist, you're able to experience that world, but you'll never be at home in it the way either a native or someone who makes their home in that other culture is. You'll always be a tourist. Now, there are tourists who know their way around. There are places you go to that you've never been to before, and you're really an outsider. And there are other places that you visit and you do feel at home in, but you're still a tourist. Rav Kook said, in order to, part of having a healthy culture is to develop our own modern Hebrew literature. And just like those other classic world authors I've mentioned, develop their writing from within the sources of their culture, modern Hebrew literature is going to do that, drawing on our bookshelves. And young Agnon, his name wasn't even Agnon yet. He arrives in Jaffa in 1908. His name is Shmuel Yosef Tchatchkis. Tchatchkis was his birth name. Agnon is a pen name he takes shortly after arriving. And Rav Kook quickly identifies this young Agnon as the type of author we need to accomplish this. Agnon, the story is told that, you know, Agnon had been writing stories and he'd begun publishing things, and Rav Kook was very interested, and Rav Kook asked to see some of his writing. Agnon's most important work written in that early period in the land of Israel is a long novella. It was published first serially in the newspaper and then as a kind of standalone book. It was his first publication in book form, a work called V'haya Ha'akov L'Mishor. In English, it was recently translated in our series as And the Crooked Shall Be Made Straight from Toby Press. And it's a kind of tragic tale of a man and his wife back in Buchach, in Agnon's hometown. It's set about a century prior to its publication. And it's actually the story of an aguna and the birth of a mamzer, a woman whose husband disappears, not aguna in the contemporary sense of a man who refuses to give his wife a get, but in the classic halachic sense, he disappears. And accidentally, or mistakenly, I should say, the rabbis allow her to remarry, misunderstanding a piece of the evidence, which leads them to believe that he's dead. In fact, he's very much alive. And when he finally arrives, long delayed, back in town, he discovers it's the eve of the Brit Milah of the son that was born to her from her second marriage. They had actually been childless when they were married. And what he does and the decisions he makes and the self-destruction involved. Well, this is not exactly the Mesilat Yesharim. But this is a story of the birth of a mamzer. Of course, no one in town knows this. Only this tragic fellow who takes the secret with him to his grave, and we, the readers. But everyone else in town are unaware that this child that was born is a mamzer, a halachic bastard, unable, if anyone were to know, to marry into the mainstream Jewish community because he was born out of wedlock. She was legally married, halachically married to this fellow who was mistakenly presumed dead. So Agnon was a little skeptical about showing this work to Rav Kook. It's a little scandalous. I mean, by our standards today, it's not even rated PG, it's rated G. But the standards, you understand, the standards have been lowered, in the last century plus. But because of its kind of sensitive halachic nature, he's skeptical about showing it to Rav Kook. Ultimately, he does. Rav Kook reads it before it's published, when it's still in manuscript. And he hands it back to Agnon. And according to Agnon's report, Rav Kook said to him, Zehu sipur ivri be'emet. This is an authentic, the word ivri at this point in history is tricky. Ivri means both Jewish, but it also means Hebrew, meaning in the Hebrew language, meaning it means both. This is an authentic Hebrew-Jewish story. Hanoveya min hatzinarot lelo shum mechitza, which flows through the divine channels with no barrier. Now, whatever that Kabbalistic metaphor means is not important. But what Rav Kook was saying, or it's not important for us right now, but what Rav Kook was saying was that this is exactly the type of work that the new Jewish society in the land of Israel needs. It is not the guide for the perplexed. It is not a Musar Sefer, although we can learn a lot from modern literature. It's a tragic modern tale. But it's one which emanates culturally from the wellsprings of Judaism. That's what modern literature does. And I think that story encapsulates something of why Rav Kook saw something positive in Agnon's writing. Agnon maintained a lifelong, of course, Rav Kook passed away in 1935. Agnon lived until 1970, but Agnon maintained a lifelong reverence for Rav Kook. And those of you that will come to visit us here in the Beit Agnon on your next visit to Jerusalem, you can hear some of the many anecdotes that get passed around about their relationship and about the time that Rav Kook came to visit here and other such things.
What is your favorite Agnon story or book and why?
Oh, well, that's a tricky question. I tend to favor his novellas, his kind of longer short stories. I think that's the format where he's able to be most Agnonian, meaning able to be most intertextually engaged and to maintain this work of dialogue with the classical sources most successfully. In a longer novel, it's hard to keep that up. And in a shorter story, and he has some very microscopically short stories, one page, in some of the shorter stories, it you don't even notice it because it's too brief. So there's a number of these novellas that appear in different volumes in Hebrew and in the English editions. The English editions don't necessarily map on to the Hebrew editions. The stories are rearranged and grouped together differently in the English editions. In English, we have a volume called Two Scholars Who Were in Our Town and Other Novellas. It's a collection of four novellas. And I think the four there are very, very representative of, some of his best work. It includes, besides the title story, it includes the story Tehillah, which I had mentioned earlier, which is clearly his most, let's say, beloved story. It's the story that, over the decades, the reading public has maintained you know, the greatest affection for. That might be because it remains eternally on the Bagrut exam, on the matriculation examinations in high school. So unfortunately, you know, for many people, it's one of the only stories that they've ever read. But in terms of the novels, the longer stories, he's got a novel called Sipur Pashut, in English called A Simple Story, which I often recommend to people as a starting point if you want to read something longer. But ultimately, it doesn't really matter. You know, there's stories that are more well known. There's stories that are less well known. There's stories that, you know, even in Hebrew, are not, you know, widely known or often read or, you know, dealt with in the scholarly literature. But among the kind of classics, those are some of the ones that, you know, people come to again and again.
Tell us just a little bit about Toby Press, what you have done, and what the goals are going forward.
So the Toby Press is an imprint of Korain Publishers, which of course is probably well known to many of our listeners. Korain has a number of different imprints, including Magid books, which are books of Jewish thought, and Toby Press, which are works of modern literature, although largely Hebrew literature in translation. And the publisher, Mr. Matthew Miller of Jerusalem, you know, who himself is a great lover of Agnon and classic Hebrew literature, had this idea to put out revised and new editions of Agnon in translation. And I came on as the series editor of that project. The project grew in the making. When we started, we thought it was going to be 5 volumes or 7 volumes. In the end, it was 15 volumes. At the moment, the project is complete, although we did not translate all of Agnon's writings into English. What we did was we took the most important stories that had not yet been translated. The history of Agnon translation is a story that has not yet been fully told. Agnon was already being translated into European languages and into English very early on. I think the earliest Agnon translations were taking place in the early 1920s. Agnon's publisher, Shlomo Zalman Shokin of the Shokin Press, who controls the rights to Agnon's writings in Hebrew until this day, Shokin understood that in order to have a world-class author, a kind of author that some committee in Stockholm might pay attention to, you cannot leave him untranslated in Hebrew, because no one will know he exists. Remember, the choice to write in Hebrew, which Agnon makes at the age of 20 in 1908, was very curious, because in the 19-teens and 20s and 30s, there were many, many, many millions more readers in Yiddish than there were in Hebrew. Economically, it made absolutely no sense. You can only understand it as an ideological decision to become a Hebrew writer. Financially, it made no sense. I mean, just the amount of Yiddish writing that was going on. Unfortunately, now we don't read much of that Yiddish literature, neither in the original, because so few of us can read Yiddish, or in translation. We know, you know, the Tevye stories of Shalom Aleichem and a few other things. You know, in the end, it was a safer bet to go with Hebrew literature, but at the time, it didn't make any sense. And Shokin understood that in order to become a world class writer, you have to have translations, and he financed many of those early translations. But you know, some of Agnon's most important works had not been translated to English until our series, and frankly, some stories that nobody paid much attention to when they came out, and which are largely forgotten in Hebrew today, were translated decades ago. There was no kind of plan for what got translated, you know, when. So what we did was we collected up the existing translations and we revised them. And then we commissioned new translations of the most significant untranslated works and put them out. And our editions all have some kind of ancillary material, a new forward, a new afterword, in very many cases, annotations, illustrated annotations that fill in that kind of source work and referencing to the classical sources, to the rabbinic sources, to historical realia that he's making mention of that, you know, frankly, no reader, you know, in Hebrew today would necessarily know unless they happen to be a professor of that particular moment in history. So our volumes have that kind of scholarly apparatus that fill in those blanks. But that material is in the back of the book because you're meant to encounter the literary text itself, unadulterated and unadorned, and to immerse yourself into it. And if you have a question, then you can look up something in the reference material elsewhere in the volume. At the moment, the series it's been completed now already for a few years. After we completed that list of the most important untranslated works, so then the things that were lower down on the list now have moved up, and there are other things that I think, you know, I'd like to undertake. And it could be in time we'll come back and put out another volume or two of new materials.
This has been fascinating. We can go on and on, but unfortunately, time, I believe, is up. Now, first of all, thank you very, very much, Rabbi Sacks. We encourage all our visitors and listeners to explore the world of Shai Agnon, to buy the books, whether it's in the original, if you can do it, or obviously in the translated. And Rabbi Sacks mentioned the Shai Agnon House, which I believe is down the block from the American Embassy.
It's, yes, well, we say the American Embassy is down the block from us because we got there first.
The American Embassy is down the block from the Shai Agnon.
Next time you have to come to renew your passport, you can come in to visit the Agnon House. You can find us online at agnonhouse.org.il. The visiting hours, you don't need to make an appointment when the house is open. You can come and do the self-guided tour. It's worth the visit. And of course, you can find the catalog of the Toby Press books on their website. And the books themselves, of course, available in most of the chain bookstores here in Israel, at least, or on Amazon. You can find them.
Okay. Thank you again very, very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.